In this town, if you want justice, you have to take it. Cynthia Rothrock as Christy Jones. A street fighter searching for a man who murdered her sister. An undefeatable champion driven by insanity.
What are you doing with my wife?
If he can't have Anna, he'll kill anyone who even reminds him of her.
Come on, tough guy!
Sergeant Nick DeMarco knows his name.
Breathe!
Christy Jones is determined to find the killer.
You're crazy. My name's not Anna.
But every wasted minute costs another life.
I'm talking about my sister. Your ass is mine.
Hello and welcome to the Video Killers Podcast. I'm your host, Tim Hawley, one half of Tape Freaks, and I'm joined by my two amazing co-hosts. First off, the other half of Tape Freaks, Colette Ritchie. How are you?
Oh, I'm well. Thank you for asking.
And sometimes contributing person to Tape Freaks and our wonderful editor who's going to edit out all of my ums and mess ups, Greg Kay. How are you?
I'm good.
You've probably the most contributed to Tape Freaks at this point.
I think him and Izzy might be tied at this point.
That's true. Yeah. Okay. Well, great.
But I had to write about a talking cat.
Is that a cat?
Four paws, kind of furry. Yep, I think so.
Yeah. Did we get a cat?
No. Why?
Oh, I did see a cat, that one.
What does it say? Duffy. Yeah? But there's no address. So, Duffy, what should I do?
Wow, you have a really nice house.
I like cats.
Yeah, he's cool, I guess. Me and my dad were actually thinking about getting a cat.
New day to start over. Phil 2.0.
You can talk, but only once.
I don't make the rules, Phil.
There's a cat in here.
I know there's a cat in here. It was just talking to me. A talking cat? That's just stupid. That's the best you could come up with?
I'm a talking cat, but I can only talk to a person once.
I look like something that the cat dragged in.
I'm doing it!
Keep loose! Don't cry against the water!
I like you taking things seriously. But you don't have to all the time with me.
You both talked to a cat, didn't you? And the cat talked back, didn't it?
That's weird.
Oh, that's right. We really.
That counts as at least three.
I was going to ask Colette, Timothy Bottoms or Sam Bottoms?
I don't know. I like saying Timothy Bottoms better than Sam Bottoms. Oh, Sam Bottoms is kind of fun too. I can't choose.
and then Greg, since we've already put you through the ringer with testing this whole recording, you having second thoughts about doing a podcast?
Yes. No, just kidding. It's fun. This is fun.
The modern day equivalent of being in a band or talking about starting your own band is a podcast. We finally did it. It just took us a pandemic to finally launch our own podcast that we've been talking about for way too long.
True story.
So that's fun. I guess we'll just start off with what we've been watching or listening to or doing this week. You want to start off, Greg? I feel like you've watched more than we have.
I've been pretty busy this week. Let's see. I watched Magic Cop, which is technically part of the Mr. Vampire movie series.
Is it actually connected to it?
In a sense. It's got a lot of the same actors in one of them, which is Ching Ying Lam, which is the main actor in all the Mr. Vampire movies.
Yeah.
And he's in this, and you'll see a lot of the same actors pop up from those movies. It's also known as Mr. Vampire 5.
Oh, is it really? There's also, but there's also some of the same spell with like the paper stuff, like, right? Like in a lot of the hopping vampire movies where they do the spell and they put the paper on the forehead. They right. do, there's a lot of paper spell stuff happening in Magic Cop, right?
To be honest, not that I remember now, but it could easily be a Mr. Vampire movie. It had the same energy, the same comedy, the same actors.
right.
I loved it. It was, I'm already a big fan of the Mr. Vampire movies. This one was probably my favorite of any of those movies already.
Yeah. Yeah, that's I've seen the last time I saw Mr. Vampire, and I saw that and Magic Cop, and they were both bootleg VHSs in the late 90s, and they're both ones that I've been wanting to revisit for a long time. They were both recommended to me, but I guess I never understood that they were connected. I remember that there was the same guy in both of them, but I didn't realize that it was that they were in the, technically in the same universe or whatever at that time.
Yeah, I wouldn't even say they're in the same universe. I have a feeling calling it number five was just capitalizing off that the success of those movies.
Marketed in the same universe.
Right.
I want to watch it again already. And it was just so fun.
Yeah. I guess, should we go around? So we should start with the first one that we watched as a group, which was Crocodile Fury, a Godfrey Ho masterpiece.
It is. Is it a masterpiece?
I don't know.
It
has hopping vampires.
It's a piece of something.
It's a lot.
Can you explain the plot, even though we just watched it for the second time?
Maybe.
Good luck.
There's a crocodile that eats everybody.
Mm-hmm. It delivers on like the Crocodile Fury.
So many people, almost an entire village. And then there's a guy who's walking around and barfs up a bunch of bugs.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And then there's more crocodile eating people.
He runs into hopping vampires when he barfs up the bugs.
Oh, yeah. He does run into hopping vampires. That's about all I can remember. That's like 20 minutes of the movie.
There's a witch with a...
There's a witch. She keeps popping up out of nowhere and like reading a crystal ball about stuff.
Mm-hmm.
There's like a cop in it, I guess.
And the crocodile is a woman who has been reincarnated as a crocodile who's in love with one of the townspeople.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So she's basically eating everyone because she's angry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or vengeful.
And that's making her fiance mad. He's like, stop eating people. And she's like, oh, stop telling me what to do. But she's cursed, right? Like, there's a bunch of people who are cursed, and they are like crocodiles.
Yeah, I think so. That sounds about right. No, like I said, it's a Godfrey Ho movie. So
there's so much happening.
Yeah,
it is nonstop.
They are cursed. You're right. But I don't know if we ever caught the reason why she's doing that.
Yeah.
What the end game was, I don't.
Well, I mean, she was jealous of other people in the town, right? Because she's like, he tries to reason with the crocodile at one point, and then she transforms back into herself, and she doesn't want to wait for him to die so they can be back together again.
Maria, just be content being a crocodile.
If you really cared for me, Jack, you'd be a crocodile too. And then we could both be together right away. What do you think?
As you wish.
I hate you now.
No!
So she wants to just basically like make him miserable so he will die or something. But that might be
that's reading. Not even clear when they're talking. I was paying actual attention at that point. I was like, I still don't know what they're saying to me. Like, they're saying stuff to each other. And I'm like, I don't know. Some of that made sense. Some of it didn't. Some of it maybe connected up.
So little made sense. But I will say this.
So good, though.
The first 10 minutes was just pure carnage.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's like on that small fishing town, right? And they're all and the crocodile just goes down the river in the middle of that town.
Yeah.
And starts pulling people off the docks, out of the boats. One person, I swear, dives head first into the mouth.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. He knocks another guy off a pole.
That's another guy off a pole. I think he grabs a couple infants out of a crib. You know, it's pretty crazy. And the funny thing is the practical effects are really not good. It looks like paper teeth. It may be made of cardboard. I remember it's a scene later on where it's walking, and it's obviously a man, a full-size man in it. And he's got...
He's just wearing it like a spandex suit.
Right.
Crawling
he's even
around.
Got the legs. Even his normal legs are in the back. He's just hunched out. But after a while, it just kind of worked. You know, you didn't really even care because that thing was just eating everything.
After it eats like three or four people, you're like, I'm on board with whatever this is. And then it eats like 17 more people. And then you're at the 10-minute mark.
Yeah. It was fun.
Was that your first non-Ninja Godfrey Ho movie that you can remember? Or... have you seen a number of his stuff?
I've seen a few of his things. Everything of his is what I imagine a fever dream is like. Crocodile Fury definitely did that.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah, there's like the, I mean, everybody sort of knows the Richard Harris. Like if they know, or I say not everybody knows, but
not
if people know Godfrey Ho, they know the Richard Harris, whatever, movies with where he's got the Garfield phone and he's like assembling the ninja groups. They use that scene in like a dozen of those movies. They just kind of reuse it over and over again and just dub it or subtitle it differently just to communicate something different. But I think he only actually acted in one or maybe two movies of Godfrey Ho's, but he's in like 20 or more. he just reused this footage over and over and over again.
That was kind of a normal practice of his, right? That reuse footage from not only his movies, but other movies.
Yeah, it's all cut and paste for the most part. I mean, he did some where I think he filmed the whole thing. I think some of the Cynthia Rothrock movies, I think he filmed from start to finish, like they were like full productions. But there's a number of movies that he directed. Like there's no way that any person can direct 30 movies in a year. Like, mm-hmm. And that's what he was doing consistently for year and year. Like, so it's just like with that, he's clearly buying up footage, using stock footage and then reusing footage that he had previously shot or from another movie that was unrelated that he just intercuts together to try and tell a narrative and then slaps ninja whatever on the title, ninja the protector, ninja terminator, ninja the destroyer, or whatever. So like that's a lot of those movies are of his. But then you do have gems in there like Crocodile Fury or
Robo Vampire,
Thunder of Gigantic Serpent is another great one where it's like a kaiju monster movie mixed with like a coming of age like kids movie, and then there's like a really violent drug crime movie, and you just mash those three together and it's just sort of this incoherent mess, but it's a really enjoyable incoherent mess.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go, three movies that you recommend.
Oh yeah,
I'm thoroughly convinced that Godfrey Ho is a legit maniac.
Yeah, he teaches film studies now in Hong Kong at a school.
That's awesome.
I imagined him like a Roger Corman kind of guy where he's like, if you meet him, you're like, oh my God, you're just so subdued and like all the like wackiness is just happening in his head. Like he's thinking about it real hard, but like it doesn't come out of him any other way. That's how I imagined Godfrey Ho.
He looks like a sweet little nerdy old man.
Yeah, he looks like a very nice person. Like you're just like, oh, hello. Wait, what do you do? Movies, huh?
Huh.
All right, Greg, back to you. What else have you watched this week?
I was on a kick, and I watched Righting Wrongs with Cynthia Rothrock. Mm-hmm. And I followed it up with Yes, Madam, with Cynthia Rothrock and Michelle Yeoh.
Mm-hmm.
Both are really, really good. Yes, Madam didn't have a plot that I can make of.
Yeah, we watched that one not long ago, and I honestly couldn't tell you. Are there cops?
Yeah, so that was just Cynthia Rothrock and her playing cops that didn't get along at first, but... they made it work, and both are really good, but that was Cynthia Rothrock's first movie, and she's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
She should have been doing more. I mean, well, she did a lot of stuff, but I can't say she should have done more when she was in like 50 movies in the 80s.
Right.
And that movie was pretty standard. That was like the first wave of a bunch of female-led action films that came out of the Hong Kong during that era, and Cynthia Rothrock alone made countless movies like that. But the one I really enjoyed was Righting Wrong. It's just Cynthia Rothrock starring. It's same story as the other one, really, in a sense. She's a cop that comes in and blah, blah, blah. But they went so dark in this movie. You know, I don't want to say too much, but Game of Thrones. I mean, they're not no one's safe in this movie. You know? And I loved it.
I say Undefeatable is a really fun one, and despite there's like a really awful, brutal rape scene in it.
Yeah.
But the rest of the movie is super fun.
Mm-hmm.
And it's complete insanity, and it's a Godfrey Ho one. That one has some hilarious moments in it. I remember the Lady Dragon 1 and 2 were pretty fun.
The Spirit of the Dragon. Robert Ginty, Richard Norton, and Cynthia Rothrock. Lady Dragon.
Those were ones we watched quite a while ago. So, like, I'm having a hard time remembering the difference between the two, and also, like,
yeah,
what, like,
was is the one he just watched? Is that the one where it's the two comedic guys in it?
Yes, madam.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we just watched that one like in February. Like, we just recently watched that one.
It's actually three guys, but there's two of them you see the most. But there's one guy who's doing the counterfeit in his room, in their apartment. Yeah. And everyone who enters that room has to go through like this maze to fight him. It's really a good movie for action.
Yeah. Yeah, they're like a kind of like a weird Three Stooges kind of crew, like, yeah, right?
Definitely.
It's like all slapsticky. Yeah. Well, then, we watched a bunch of aquatic monster movies this last weekend with everybody over Zoom. So the other ones we watched that night, which Greg, you dipped out for, but it was Night of the Sharks, starring Treat Williams and Antonio Fargas.
James Ziegler has double crossed the mafia. He's on the run.
This will be the last time you have to pay me.
But there's no place to hide. Now his brother has something they want.
You may fall worth of diamonds.
And enough evidence to put them inside.
What do you think?
It could be dangerous.
He's ready to take them on.
You're signing your own death sentence, David.
On his own ground.
So why don't you take off?
Playing by his rules. Night of the Sharks.
With absolutely no nighttime scenes.
Yeah, it was Night of the Sharks. There was some sharks, but it was nothing happened at night.
Nope.
Nothing at all.
There was not even a cloud in the sky any of the time.
It was very sunshiny. a lot of the sharks were definitely stock footage.
Mm-hmm.
Well, clear sky of the sharks just doesn't have the same ring.
I mean, it kind of does. It makes it stand out. Like
Day of the Sharks? I mean, it's
Day of the Sharks. I don't know.
Yeah, the majority of the movie is centralized around a bunch of evidence on a compact disc, which was like very high tech for the time period. And there's like a diamond heist, and they feed the CD to a shark. So they got to try and get the CD out of the shark belly.
First they hide it in a steak.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's how you got to get it in. If you're going to put a CD in a shark,
put it in a, cut straight through a steak. Shove it in there. Toss
the
it
sharks
in the
just won't eat anything. You know, license like plates, yes, but like CDs, no.
Oh, yeah.
And everybody knows that sharks, they just swallow meat like whole. They won't chew it.
Yeah. And they don't digest.
Yeah. They're just, like they're swimming suitcases, basically.
Yeah.
Greg, what else do you got?
Well, you didn't talk about Treat Williams. How was he in the movie, though?
He's fine. Antonio Fargas, I feel like, was a little bit more comical and more like chewing a little bit more scenery.
Yeah, he was definitely funner. Treat Williams was just being like, it's almost like he was a brat. Like,
yeah,
he was just like he was just obnoxious.
He was supposed to be the hero, but he just kept like just kind of being a jerk. He's supposed to be like tough, so he can like kind of beat up anybody with no effort. But he just sort of comes off as just sort of like he doesn't want to be in the movie, I feel like, most of the time. And he's just sort of being a jerk to everybody.
Yeah.
But maybe it wasn't the case. But like that's how his character was.
Yeah, maybe that he couldn't pull it off quite. And it just came off as
being
a little arrogant and weird.
How late was that in the career? Was that 89?
It was 88, I think. Yeah. I'm pretty sure. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm just wondering if that was before or after Deep Rising, and I think it was before.
I think it was before, yeah. It's right around the same time period as Dead Heat, which he's in.
And he was great in Dead Heat.
Yeah, and I think that's great. I believe that's just after Night of the Sharks. So it's like it's weird that he's just kind of bland in Night of the Sharks, but he's really good in like the next year. But maybe it just had to do with the director or something.
Yeah. Or maybe it had to do with the script was called Night of the Sharks. CD.
taking place entirely in the daytime. Hiding CDs and sharks.
That's good. I kind of miss Treat Williams. I haven't seen him around in ages, so.
Yeah, when I found that poster, I was like, well, whatever this movie is, I got to check it out. Treat Williams, it's diamonds and sharks. Come on.
Yeah, right? Sounds like a winner.
It was still pretty fun.
Yeah.
It was fun?
It was fun. I'm not, I don't want to talk that badly about it. I mean, it was an entertaining watch, especially at like, I don't know, 2 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
I did watch a newer film. I watched Host, that's on exclusively on Shudder right now.
Hmm.
And that's about 6 friends that get together for a weekly Zoom call. And this week they decide they're going to drink and do a seance. So they hire a medium, logs into their Zoom call. One thing leads to another. And one
hijinks
ensue.
Yeah.
It was pretty fun. It's short. It's under an hour.
Mm-hmm.
Just under an hour. And it really does utilize it looks like a Zoom call the whole time. It relies heavy on jump scares, but they were good. It gets a little contrived after a while on how they keep bringing the camera with them everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is really hard to do in all found footage. It seems like you know, it's an issue all the time. But I recommend watching it late at night on your laptop.
Right.
Or maybe your phone. I think this is one movie that really works. And I guarantee it'll spook you out.
Hey.
Hey.
Hi, guys.
Hey, guys.
Tina.
Caroline.
Hi, Teddy.
Let's do a shot glass to us.
Okay, everyone get in. 3, 2, 1.
Have you ever done anything like this before?
I've never done this over Zoom. Obviously, we're not physically together, but there's no reason why Spirit can't communicate over the internet.
Nothing's gonna happen.
Visualize us sitting in a circle. Spirit, we invite you to use us to pass on any communication. Is there anyone there? Please come forth.
What was that?
Sweet. Yeah. Yeah. I haven't read much about it. I've just been hearing things from people that people have been enjoying it. So yeah, we'll have to check that out this week. The next aquatic monster movie we watched this weekend, which we all watched, which was called Hydra, or otherwise known as The Sea Serpent. I don't have the director's name in front of me, but it's the Spanish director who did all the Blind Dead movies. It's his final film. And it features some great miniatures, puppet sea monster. You got Ray Milland in it and Timothy Bottoms. What did you guys think of that one?
I think I remember liking that one. Is that the one I only saw half of, though?
No. I think you saw the whole thing.
Hmm. You were there.
I was there? Was I there?
yeah. It was corny. Corny's not the word. It was, you know, a rubber monster. And at first it was kind of silly because they took it seriously, at least serious enough.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Timothy Bottoms obviously made a deal with the director that he'd make it, but only one take and he's out.
Right.
You know? Yeah.
Well, the dubbing, I mean, everybody seemed like they were dubbed and the dubbing was insane. And then the dialogue was even more insane. Like, it was definitely like a first draft script that they were going off of, because it's like, there's a point where like somebody's like, we need to go find an important man.
Yeah, that's why I started to, I was like doing something else. I was like, well, this is good, but I don't need to pay attention to the dialogue because apparently they didn't either.
Exactly.
Yeah, and Ray Milland is like, seems like he's drunk throughout the movie, or like slurring a speech or something.
There's some rooms waiting for us up in the mental hospital.
You're going to fight that thing? With what? How?
With flare pistols.
You're going to use flare pistols against that? You're crazy.
We only want to scare it. We mean no harm to the creature. We just like to persuade it to go somewhere else, that's all.
I felt drunk watching it. Now I'm drinking water.
I do remember there was a lot of monster scenes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's where the movie flourished. It was in their miniatures. I thought the miniatures were great, especially mm-hmm. the scene at the dock with the old crazy guy.
Yeah.
It's obviously miniatures, but all the ships around there are lit on fire. A friend of ours said that the two hardest thing to do in models and miniatures is water and fire, and they did both really well in that.
Yeah, mm-hmm. They were doing it both in the same shot for a while.
Yeah.
Yeah,
there's a bunch of explosions, and there's like that whole train sequence, the train bridge. And
yeah, and sometimes it was kind of obvious, but it still looked really good. You know, mm-hmm. I'd rather take that than CGI, you know, or CG effects of the train. And then the scene that seemed kind of bizarre to me that it was even in there, but they did it because it was fucking awesome. I don't know. It was when the serpent attacked the lighthouse. Really well done. I mean, it just didn't really make sense, but
all of a sudden
it came out of the water, wrapped around the entire lighthouse, and it pulled it down. It was...
Yeah, I was like, at that point, I was like, so is the serpent like attracted to light? And it's like, no, it just, I don't know, it just went after the lighthouse, I guess.
It was just
I don't
like, fuck this particular lighthouse. Yeah. Like,
yeah.
Goodbye. It was like a rubber, like, sock puppet, like, monster almost, but like, it was hilarious and fun, I thought.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it had the googly eyes. Yeah. You know, it looked like it was kind of cute, you know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, totally.
Eating everyone, you know. But
Sigmund the Sea Monster.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was. Yeah, it was fun. The only thing that's sort of weird now I think about it, it became a courtroom drama for about 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Which.
Oh, I loved that part. Nothing, like one sentence to the next even didn't make any sense at all. And I was like, this is amazing. And this is all you're focusing on is them speaking in a room together. And I have no idea what happened or why you're there.
It's because they blamed him for the boat sinking and said he's crazy.
Yeah. But for like a really long time, I thought it was a flashback to the first boat that they were talking about having sunk and like.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so mean. That was ridiculous.
Yeah, that's right. Timothy Bottoms had a history of a boat accident, and everyone said he was a drunk. Yeah. So then when this happened, and the Hydra attacked his boat. So then what's he do? He goes crazy, or he goes wild about telling everyone about the Hydra, which is not helping his case at all at the time.
Right. Breaks into a hospital to try and get that woman, like to shake sense into her and convince her to... who also saw the sea serpent to like
and
help him.
Everyone thinks he's crazy.
Yeah,
he's in the crazy.
So the two crazies are running. They go to find. They have to find the unimportant man, which happens to be Ray Milland, who's like a sea serpent specialist or something. And he doesn't want to join them until they're like, "Yeah, but we saw it." And he's like, "Well, how do I know you're telling the truth? Because we're telling the truth." Oh, okay, cool. Here we go.
Yeah.
Like, it's like
almost take verbatim. Much. It was kind of like the stuff in that where it was like.
Yeah.
They weren't even just like in like, oh, this lady was also there and like she's just down the street. He like didn't have to like travel a ways to find her. Like
I think they're in the same city.
Oh, maybe I was just interpreting it wrong.
I did love how Ray was like not in, and then when he's in, he's freaking all in.
All
he's like,
in.
He's like let's go break into like a naval facility, steal a boat.
Yeah.
It's like where's your sense of adventure? Let's break the law.
Yeah, we're going to commit multiple felonies and have the FBI definitely following us
around.
He
disappears and comes back like an armload of dynamite. And it's like, what is happening now?
Literally, that happened in the movie. Literally.
Oh, man. Did you watch anything else? Or we have one more aquatic monster movie that I guess I watched. The two of you didn't. Or you, Greg, you watched part of it. But did you watch anything else?
I did watch one more movie. It was a Reb Brown movie.
Oh, sweet Reb Brown.
Yeah. I don't know about you guys, but at my house, we're Reb Brown fans.
Yes, absolutely.
And it was called Strike Commando, and he's pretty good. He's doing what he does, and he's doing a Stallone ripoff, you know, almost 100%, which felt weird because he can just be Reb Brown.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, I loved him in Uncommon Valor with Gene Hackman. I thought that was a great movie, and I thought he was very good at it. And we all know him in Space Mutiny,
mm-hmm.
which is really good.
The made-for-TV Captain America movies, right?
Mm-hmm. And the Captain America movies, yes, sir. But this one, he has a scene that he cries. And I don't know if you guys ever seen Julianne Moore cry, but I have a theory that's her hook. You know, they're always like, all right, well, we need someone to cry. Get Julianne Moore on the phone. There's a big crying scene in there. Get her.
Mm-hmm.
And she's an ugly crier because she's just all in.
Mm-hmm.
He has a scene where he's bonding with this little kid in the village that's safe. It doesn't matter how he gets there. But he's talking to this kid. And he's telling him all these lies about Disneyland for some reason. He's like, in Disneyland, popcorn grows on trees. And every day it's, you know, pockets of sunshine. And the kid's like, oh, wow. And of course, the mom's like, hey, dude, don't give the kid dreams. We're stuck in this village.
Yeah.
Let's wreck it out. And even I was like, why is he doing that? The poor kid's like, I'm coming with you. And he's like, yeah no, you're not. But, so he bonds with the kid. That happens. And then he comes back later. And spoiler alert, but the kid's died, you know, and the whole town's dead. And he cries. And it was an amazing performance. My wife started crying along with them. That's how great the cry was.
A Bruno Matai movie?
Yes, and a Bruno Matai movie. I forgot to mention that. Bruno Matai directed this, and she was crying.
Amazing.
I'd be lying if I didn't feel a little up my throat after seeing that. You know, looking over, she's crying. I'm like, oh, God. Damn you, Reb Brown. But yeah, Reb Brown, I always recommend at least give him a shot. He's fun.
Nice. Yeah, that's one we've owned, but we've yet to watch.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The last aquatic monster movie we watched was Crocodile 2, the Italian sequel to...
Killer Crocodile 2,
directed by Gianetto Rossi, the effects artist best known for The Beyond. I know him from The Beyond and High Tension and The House by the Cemetery, but he also was the effects artist on Dune. He's
still around, I believe, too.
Yeah, fantastic effects artist. And the effects in Killer Croc 2, okay. I mean, the croc itself is pretty fun. He did the effects for the first one, and I think the first one's maybe a little bit better, even though it's just a pretty blatant Jaws ripoff. But the second one's pretty fun. I mean, there's some really amazing giant croc coming out of the water, chomping people, blood splatter effects. For some reason... they really like killing little kids in both movies, it seems like. there's a point where they go, there's like a whole like choir group on in like multiple boats going down the river, and the croc just like annihilates them.
Jeez. It's
really odd, kind of out of nowhere. There's also an amazing shot where somebody jumps on the back of the crocodile and then they roll through the water, but it's just clearly a crocodile toy with an action figure taped to the back that they're rolling around. So that's worth watching for. It's pretty fun. I mean, when you watch one of these like aquatic monster movies, you're looking for those great like set piece action shots of like the monster, what you could see of the monster. Mm-hmm. And this totally delivers. Like you see the croc full on and you see them battling it out with the croc, and it's a practical effect giant crocodile that they built for the first movie they just reused for the second one. And it's based on interview with Gianetto Rossi, like he didn't really want to direct the movie. He's only directed a couple movies, but he was basically said that the producer just wanted him to do the effects and to direct it so they could save a paycheck. They would like just, if he did a dual roles, they wouldn't have to pay two people, which is pretty funny, but it's worth checking out. And the Severin put out an amazing Blu-ray double disc of this. Like the deluxe version has both the first and the second movie in it, but the second disc is only in the deluxe version, which has the second movie. But on that, there's actually a feature length documentary about Gianetto Rossi that we also watched, which is great. It's just candid interviews with him and a few other people that like kind of know his career, just talking kind of through his movies from working with like for Fellini and stuff, and then eventually working on like with Fulci and all of these like Italian crazy, like over the top, like effects movies. But then eventually going to Hollywood and working on Dune and all these ones too, which is pretty amazing. So yeah, that's worth checking out if people are interested in effects work.
And that's still being issued.
It's still available. Yeah, for sure. All right. Well, we should probably get to our main subject here, which is we're kind of an introduction of the three of us. We're going to go through, we were each tasked with picking five films that we really like and kind of speaks to our tastes. I figured like it's not really like our favorites. It's just five films that kind of like give someone an idea of like where our tastes lie. And I had a really hard time pulling my list together. I don't know about you guys, but it was, I was changing it all the way up until the moment we got on to recording. So it is even that I'm not satisfied with my five.
Likewise.
I wrote mine while I was watching an episode of How to Make a Murderer. Or what's it? Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
Making a Murderer. Yeah. And it, like, it took me like 10 minutes, 20 minutes.
You're ridiculous.
And I like my list.
Yeah.
I'm okay with my list, but it's not gonna, you know, definitely not favorites, or I mean, they're favorites, but
yeah, it's not like top five movies of all time. Just
yeah. Right.
I was trying to think of it as like warm blanket movies, movies that I like go back to over and over again. One and two were movies that sort of I caught at a specific time period and like sort of changed my tastes or in some way or another. Maybe not every single one of them, but they all kind of helped to kind of like form my tastes as a movie watcher.
Yeah, and that's what I went with. Yeah.
I went for things that I'd seen multiple times and that had like something that I could really clearly remember in them or some thing that like, yeah,
okay,
influenced my taste for the rest of my life after that.
Yeah. Why don't you start?
What? Me?
Yeah.
No, you're pretty excited.
Yeah, you're happy with your list.
Yeah, you're very happy. Mine.
Well, then I'm gonna set the bar really high.
Okay.
I'm thinking about changing my list right now. That's,
So, in no particular order, I have The Big Sleep.
Can I help you, sir?
Oh yeah, I'm looking for a good mystery on something off the beaten track, like the Maltese Falcon.
Well, that was a fascinating story. But here's one that has everything the Falcon had and more. It's Raymond Chandler's latest bestseller, The Big Sleep. And what a picture that'll make.
You mind if I look at it?
This one? My dad was really into, like, film noir and, like, Alfred Hitchcock movies and, the Alfred Hitchcock Presents and all that kind of stuff. And he introduced me to The Big Sleep when I was in middle school. And I loved it. And I will watch that movie at any point. We watched it kind of recently with our friend who'd never seen it before. And he was like, mind was blown. He's like, that was the craziest movie ever. Like, what? I've never seen this kind of movie before. I'm like, how have you not? He's watched so many movies. I'm like, how'd you never went that direction? I don't know. But yeah.
That's the Humphrey Bogart one.
Humphrey Bogart. Yeah. Lauren Bacall. Bacall.
Yeah, I believe that's the one he met her.
Yeah.
Yeah. And their chemistry on screen obviously is great, but like all the dialogue, everybody's delivering the dialogue just amazingly. Like it's all fast talking slang terms from like the detective stuff at the time. Like, yeah. And it's also visually a very well shot noir. And the story makes sense. Like some of the noirs that I like a lot, it's like, what were they all doing? Why are they all doing that? But this is, it's just a good story.
It's a great movie. I think between that and Double Indemnity are my two favorite film noirs. Big Sleep, now it has been a couple of years, but I remember it being very twisty of a story, I guess. Yeah. Is the best way to put it. You know?
It's based on a Raymond Chandler novel, and it's like, it's a great novel. But I remember when we watched, I think we watched it, I mean, years ago, or it was that, and then like Maltese Falcon and a few other ones. And
Falcon still doesn't really make sense to me, a lot of it.
But like that made me obsessed with those movie or those like film noirs, and I went down the rabbit hole of like reading a bunch of those Raymond Chandler novels. It's really fun.
I will probably always like that like hard-boiled detective genre of everything.
The unnatural, just fast talking.
Right.
Yeah, the gritty like main character who's like, you don't know his past, but like it oozes out his pores. Like,
right. They literally don't make him like that anymore. I mean, it seems like that's a genre that had its time. Not that you can't make them, and people always try, and there's a lot of success ones, but there's something about that era and the movies that came out of that that just, it's something magical there. And even the ones that aren't really that good or known as being good are pretty fun still from that era. And
usually, at the minimum, they're like pretty to watch.
Mm-hmm.
Usually, yeah. I found that like what Ed Brubaker is, that's the closest it gets, is his comics. A lot of his comics that he writes like independently, more like not the superhero stuff necessarily, but he captures that really well.
Yeah, criminal, and there's the Hollywood one that he did recently, but they're
great.
Who's that?
Yeah, his name is Ed Brubaker. He's a really great. He's the one who actually wrote the Winter Soldier storyline in Captain America. In the comics, and then he's actually in the Winter Soldier movie, like a small cameo in the background. But he now writes for, he's like wrote on Westworld and he's done some television writing, but he's really known for his comic books and really known for his like his crime comics. He does a lot of really great kind of noir kind of spy thrillers and stuff like that too. There's like Sleeper is another one of his more famous ones. Criminal is a major one, but he's done a ton of stuff, yeah. And they're all, everything we've read of his is great.
Yeah. I just picked up something randomly at the comic book store and it was, I think it's All My Friends Are Junk. No, All My, I can't remember. It was just some one-off thing that I was like, oh, this looks nice. And I was like, oh, it's so good from beginning to end. Yeah.
All right, Greg, you're up.
And you're going to give me shit for this, I think.
There's no bad movies.
No, especially on my list right now. all right, The Last American Virgin.
Nobody has more fun than The Last American Virgin.
Me?
It's about hope.
Tonight can really be the big night.
And dreams. The highs and lows.
You're not going to get anything from
the ups and downs of growing up. The Last American Virgin, a comedy about friendship, love, and everything in between. The Last American Virgin. See it or be it. From Canon Release.
Now playing at theaters and drive-ins near you.
I've still never seen that.
Yeah.
It's a remake, actually, of an Israel film made by the same director, Boaz Davidson.
Mm-hmm.
He made a movie called Yellow Popsicle. Last American Virgin, The Last American Virgin, takes place in the 80s. It's an 80s movie through and through. It might as well have neon lights and shoulder pads. It's 100% 80s, but Yellow Popsicle took place in the 50s in Israel. Porky's ripped off Yellow Popsicle, in my mind, because that's exactly what it is. The movie was so successful that they ended up making 7 sequels to it.
Jeez. I had no idea.
And at one point, a remake happened in like 2001. Now, that movie did so successful that, of course, they did the remake, Last American Virgin, but that, the money they made off of Globus and Golem made off of this movie, the Yellow Popsicle movie, gave them enough money to start the Canon Film Group. Without the success of that movie, they wouldn't have that money because they were broke. They weren't doing well with movies. It was kind of a no-brainer to them to remake it over here.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I really love the movies because it's one of those movies I saw by myself, middle of the night. I didn't read about it anywhere. I had no idea what it was. All I knew is that my pervy 13-year-old mind saw in the film guide that it had SSC. SSC meant strong sexual content, which means boobies.
Yeah.
So I was like, well, I got to see it. And it didn't hurt that it had Diane Franklin in it from Better Off Dead.
Oh, okay.
It's got a soundtrack that just freaking rocks. The soundtrack includes The Cars, The Commodores, Blondie, The Police, Devo, Oingo Boingo, U2, The Waitresses, Quincy Jones, REO Speedwagon. It's just, it's even the first time they ever used that song, Are You Ready for the Sex Girls? Which is more famously used in Revenge of the Nerds.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm. Are you ready for the sex girls? The hot, hot, mean, hot, big, hot girls. Are you ready for the sex girls?
The thing about this movie that I keep alluding to is that it's a sex comedy. It's all silly. It's whatever. It's laughs. And there's a lot of nudity. And then it pulls like the worst evil ending ever in a movie you'll ever see. You have not seen it.
We have not.
The ending is going to stress you out. I don't know. Maybe not. But 13-year-old me, it did. You know, it made me. It's like, I never want to be in a relationship ever again.
Aww.
Or ever again. I was wishful thinking at 13. Anyway, so that's my pick. The first one is Last American Virgin.
Nice. Yeah, mine, I felt like I was going too mainstream, but I just kind of said, screw it. I'm just going to just stick with the list that I'd thrown together. But my first one is the original Evil Dead.
I've never seen that one.
Nice.
that one means, like, just meant so much to me. I'm a big fan of that series. I honestly, like, my least favorite is the Army of Darkness, because just, I'm not something about, I mean, like, I still like the movie, but it's just that the kind of weird slapstick humor goes over the top. I love the first one and how it's like, it is just a straight horror film. It's kind of creepy. It's unnerving. But it was one of the first movies that I saw. I remember seeing, and you can kind of see the bleed of the edges of like the, how they're making the movie while you're watching it, you know, like it's sort of rough around the edges to that degree. And it sort of like made me want to make movies and made me want to look more into movies and how they were made, because of the kind of handmade quality to everything in it. And so it's funny because I always kind of go back and forth about whether Evil Dead 1 or Evil Dead 2 are my favorite in the series. But if Evil Dead 1 is just, it means so much to me. And then also when Colette and I first met, that was like one of the first movies we went to go see in the theater. Mm-hmm. It was a midnight screening at the Uptown. That and like Dead Alive.
That was the first time I had seen that one.
Yeah.
Yeah. I saw Army of Darkness first, which is still my least favorite of that. Mm. But still, the first one is my favorite, yeah, because it has it's a smaller world than the second one. And I like all the makeup effects in it. I like a lot because they're more lo-fi, so they are more creepy by the nature of them.
Stop motion and things like that. And then also is one of those first DVDs I remember when DVDs first came out. It was one of the first DVDs I ever rented and like listened to a commentary track, and it kind of blew me away, the commentary track on that, like, because there's one where it's Sam Raimi and Rob Tappert, and there's one where it's just Bruce Campbell on his own, mm-hmm, and they're both talking crap about each other. And like, yeah, at this point, he's probably talking about this thing. It's like, yeah, he totally was. That's so good. So yeah, Evil Dead 1, or the original Evil Dead, I hold that as just, it's a very special movie to me, and I caught it at like an early age, and it's always kind of, I don't know, I could watch it over and over and over again.
I assume you've read the book by Bruce Campbell, Chins Could Kill.
I have never actually read the whole thing, but I've read excerpts from it.
Yeah, he gets pretty deep into the making of Evil Dead. And a lot of it you probably already know, or people probably know, just because Evil Dead's no longer a small little movie no one knows about. It's
right.
But the book's really interesting, and it really gets into a lot of the way they did the effects as, mm-hmm, well.
Yeah, hearing those stories about them like mounting to the camera to like a 2x4 and having somebody on either side and running through the woods with it, and or even like hanging from the rafters with the camera and kind of like doing a sit up, you know, like to get like the weird flip over effect, or like the fact that like you're like in one shot, it's like it's just Ted Raimi's legs like to like as a stand in because most of the actors had left at that point. it's just hilarious, like all the random stuff that they did and how it just it's so much fun.
Yeah. No, it's a great pick. Great pick.
Mm-hmm. Clint?
My turn?
Yep.
Okay, well, I'll go with one of my more mainstream ones. Well, probably my most mainstream one, which is Akira. That was not the first anime I saw when I was a teenager in the 90s, but was one of them. And we saw the dubbed version that makes no sense. And I was so determined. I had it in my head that movie has to make sense. But nobody I knew had seen any other version. And I was like, this movie has to make sense. I watched it so many times. Watched it with the subtitles on to make sure I wasn't like missing something in the dialogue. I like watched it and watched it and watched it. And a couple of years later, somebody had a bootleg of the subtitled Japanese language one. And I watched it and I was like, I knew it. I knew this movie made sense. I knew that it wasn't just a pretty movie, that it had to actually have a plot that you could follow from the beginning to the end. I've seen that movie so many times, partially because of that, and also partially because it's so very pretty and still is, I don't know, it's one of the best animated movies, I think, that is of that tone. Like, mm-hmm, very dark, very sci-fi and apocalyptic, I guess, but so beautiful and colorful, and like the character development, it is amazing. And yeah, that changed my mind about what could be like a legitimate film. But also I was really excited to figure out that puzzle.
Yeah, Neo Tokyo is one of those. It's so cool. Just want to live in that world, mm-hmm, even though it's like horrifying.
It's a very horrifying world, but it is also a big candy. Like, you're just like, oh yes, pretty, yes.
I have to admit, I've never seen that one.
Oh, it is.
Well, watch the or the subtitled one.
Yeah, the subtitled one, because that one will actually make sense. There's probably a dubbed English one now that makes more sense.
Probably not.
But the other funny thing is, like, now I recognize voices from that dub in other things, because, mm-hmm, I've heard those voices so many times. I'm like, that, I know that voice. you had to be an Akira. And look him up on IMDb. I'm like, you were.
So Akira.
Akira.
Cool. Akira. Mm-hmm. Great. Good one. It's my turn again. Okay. Yep. I'm going to keep this one simple. I won't get too deep into it because everyone knows enough about this movie. But this is a warm blanket one. Frank Capra's It's a Wonderful Life.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
It's a movie when I growing up and I didn't really get it. It was just on during Christmas all the time, and I just whatever. But one year I caught it. I guess that Christmas was really good. That season was really good because now to my seat, I just kind of have that warm feeling. It doesn't feel like the Christmas season to me unless I catch it. And here's the kicker: I can't watch it on DVD. I have to watch it on TV. You know, like if I catch it like when it plays on TV, and it's something about it, and I know everyone else is watching it. Maybe it just works. Mm-hmm.
I don't think I appreciated any part of the story except the part where I was like, "Yeah, bankers are evil."
That's where you got that from.
That's okay, where you got it. Okay. Yeah,
because I wasn't so much into the like happy stories, happy endings. Like I was like not interested in it. But I was like, yeah, no bankers. See, they're even evil in these movies.
Yeah, old rich white men, mm-hmm. Bad people.
Bad people.
All right. So my next one is a documentary. I Colette loves soul crushing documentaries, mm-hmm. But I'm always a sucker for any kind of movie that's about like a weird larger than life character or filmmaking. And mine is American Movie.
Mm. I was a failure, and I get very sad and depressed about it. And I can't be that no more. I really feel like I've betrayed myself big time. Because I think when I was growing up, I had all the potential in the world. Now I'm back to being Mark, who has a beer in his hand and is thinking about the great American script and the great American movie. And this time I cannot fail. I won't fail. It's not in me. You don't get second chances and mess them up. You'd be a fool to. Not just finishing films or in the long run getting some money, but it's right now. I feel like it's, like I said, 5, 10, 15 years ago. Now I've got the same options again, and this time I'm not going to fail. This time it's most important not to fail, just to drink and dream, but rather to create and complete.
It's like one of those movies where like I watch it, I quote it, I like it's hilarious, but it's also like, you know, heartfelt, and you just feel for all those characters because like I think we all know people like that, you know, or we know the other people where we've been in the situation where we, you know, we've been trying to make something and it's just failing, you know, or what, something like it's just everything about that movie I love. And also like I had that VHS like when it came out and watched it over and over again and just showed it to everybody I know. We went and saw a screening of Coven at the Uptown Theater when they played it before El Mariachi at one night, and it's one that I feel like I still recommend it to people, and people are still haven't seen it, which is kind of shocking to me because I feel like it's this larger than life status, but
it holds up too.
Yeah, it really does.
We watched it more recently with much, much younger people and they were in love with it.
Yeah. But we also like when I was like touring at that time period, we had a little TV VCR in our van and we used to watch it all the time while we were on the roadside. It has this like other life for me too, where like at that time period, like I feel like I was just like watching it on repeat. And then while we were in that band, we were touring, we played Summerfest in Milwaukee. And then after we got done playing, we walked over to the beer tent and Mark Borchard was there. And I got to meet him, and it was like this weird, surreal moment in my life that like it was just kind of like he was very drunk. And it was very, very nice, but it was just like it was such a strange moment. Yeah. And yeah,
it's always surreal. Yeah, another great choice. I've seen American Movie probably 20 times as well.
The commentary track on the DVD is amazing, mm-hmm. because it's Mark, Mike, and the filmmakers, and it's literally a different movie, or it's like it takes the whole movie and then it's them narrating it to create a whole nother like layer upon that, where like Mark is trying to explain what he's saying in scenes, and it almost makes it even more ridiculous because he's trying to explain his drunken ramblings and points, and it's amazing. There's a point where like one of the filmmakers says that while they're driving around while he's doing his paper route, that they kept having to stop the car for them to get out and throw up because there was so much gas fumes mm-hmm. pumping into the car that Mark just didn't notice anymore, that they were just getting physically ill from being in his car for too long. It's crazy. Yeah.
I would also argue that movie has an element of soul crushingness to it.
I mean, it's not, but there is like it ends with them screening this movie. Like, they've worked they fight tooth and nail to get this short made, like do everything in their power and everything falls in their way and they still succeed in playing it to like a packed theater at the end. It's got like a really like nice ending. I mean,
but that was not the movie they set out to make.
No, it's true. It's true. But
they screened a different movie altogether.
Northwestern never got made, but COVID did get completed and it's
and his poor his uncle. We could talk about this all podcast. Maybe we'll do that one of these times.
We'll have to have a documentary one because
all right, you're up.
Well, then I'll talk about my documentary, I guess, which is soul crushing, sort of, but also uplifting. It is. Oh, I never actually looked up the name of it. Oh no.
Sunset Story.
Sunset Story. It's a film I've only seen once, but I remember it is like burned into my soul. We saw it as part of the International Film Fest.
It was a Midwest. It was like a Midwest Film Fest thing.
Yeah, but it was at the
St. Anthony Main.
Yeah, St. Anthony Main Theater. They had oversold the screening, and so we were sitting on the floor in the back with like, I don't know, 20 other people. Like, and there's people in the sitting in the aisles. Like, so many people wanted to see that movie, and I had just like on a whim picked it, and it is one of the. I mean, maybe when I rewatch it, I'd be like, okay, maybe it's not the greatest, but it's. That it stuck with me that long, it has to be one of the greatest documentaries I've ever seen. It's a story about, or it's a documentary about these two women who meet each other at a sort of nursing home in California, where it's a really progressive nursing home. Like, I'm sure it's very expensive. Like, they're both of these women had like very large careers when they were younger. One of them is a reporter and a activist, and the other, I can't remember what her story was, but she was a little bit more on the conservative side of things. And these two women become best friends, and you're watching their friendship grow and how they support each other. And like, it gave so much agency to not only women, but like elderly people who are, you know, at a point in their lives where they need help with their care, but they're still so like there, like they're still forming new ideas and changing and growing even when they're at the end of their life. Yeah, it's such a great movie, but it does have a very sad and predictable ending in a way, but
yeah.
It's called Sunset Story,
I believe.
Yeah, I have wanted to watch it again ever since then, but like, yeah, I mean, that was 2003.
Yeah, 2003.
Yeah.
Well,
that's great. I've never heard of that. That does sound good.
Yeah, I definitely. There's been a couple of those documentaries where I'm like, "That's my elderly person goal." Like, that's where I'm working towards. Is that
like Sunset Story from 2003? Mm-hmm. All right, Greg, you're up.
All right. Well, since we're talking documentaries, I'll pick mine. Mine's a documentary, but kind of not. Mine is Terror in the Isles.
Oh.
I have the one sheet of this hanging in my living room right now. I'm a big fan of this movie. And this is the movie that I would say took me from being a kind of fair weather fan of horror to being 100% horror fan. Love any genre. And it's still to this day is my favorite genre. I don't know if it's really a documentary, though. No, to me, it is on paper, but it feels more like a commercial for horror films.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it, even though it's kind of aged now because all the movies are all pre-83, I still think it works. You've got Donald Pleasant in it, and he's hamming it up. You can tell he's having fun. And then Nancy Allen is doing her best as a host, too. They're both hosting it, if you haven't seen it. The way it's edited is they show clips from all these movies, but they also intertwine the music from all the Halloween soundtrack gets a lot of play in it. And it takes place in a movie theater watching the movies. And the audience in there is some of the most quotable stuff. I still quote stuff.
There's no question about it. Some terror films go too far.
Mommy, unlock the door.
But so do the audiences.
I want you to go down the stairs and out the front door. I want you to go down the street to the Mackenzie's house.
First they start grabbing each other, which is all very well if you have a date.
I want you to tell them to call the police.
Hey.
And before long...
Now, do you understand me?
No. No, baby, no,
people
no.
People are yelling at the characters on the screen.
Hey, watch out, baby. Watch out.
Please, Dom.
Get him!
dropped a knife. Asshole. So I always say that when someone does that in a movie. Drop the knife, asshole. It's coming on Blu-ray soon from Scream Factory.
Mm. Yeah.
It showcased a lot of movies that weren't horror as well. Like Nighthawks is not a horror film, but they talk about that one a lot. And Vice Squad is talked about. There's scenes from that. I'll agree the scenes they show are pretty horrific. But I never thought of either of those movies as horror.
They did, they were working from a small catalog at that point, I feel.
I think it's because Universal put it out.
Oh.
And I think they're I think they're pretty much limited to their movies. Exactly.
Yeah.
And I don't know if this is real, but I read somewhere that the idea was to do a series of these movies. And the next one would be on the comedy genre, and calling it Rolling in the Aisles. You know.
Oh, so. Okay. And they never even did Terror in the Aisles. This didn't do well enough for them to continue it?
Yeah, I guess not. And you know, I never even heard about it until it was on cable. But apparently it did have a theatrical run. I just there was another movie called It Came from Hollywood that came about that time. And that's got all the the SCTV gang in it. Like John Candy's in it, Gilda Radner, for some reason Cheech and Chong, Dan Aykroyd. I always liked that movie as a kid because that's the same thing. It's just them talking about all these old horror films. But rewatching it lately, they're so mean-spirited, it kind of takes away. It's like poking fun at the movies like too much.
Oh, yeah.
But Terror in the Aisles I have watched recently, and it still holds up.
Nice. Okay, so my next one is a pretty well-known, more modern one. I was going to go with at least a kind of more recent title because I feel like too many people are like, oh, they don't make good movies anymore. And it's just, complete nonsense. But it's the Indonesian action film, The Raid Redemption, otherwise just known as The Raid. It is a movie that blew me away when we first watched it, and we've watched it easily probably 20 times. Oh man, I love it every time. And I play it every time I play it for people. It kind of that haven't seen it, it just kind of blows them away. It's if you haven't seen it, it's just a very simple action movie. Takes place in one building, and the action sequences you can see have influenced how action is shot since that movie. I mean, even in the big Marvel movies, there's just a way, like before that, it was way too much of that shaky cam where they weren't really taking the time to do the choreography or learn the fight training with the actors. And The Raid just kind of steps back and you just feel the action, you feel it happening. And that's just, it's just an incredible feat what these people pulled off physically as well as like the cinematically. It's I love it absolutely so much. And I really even like the sequel Raid 2, but the first one just is one of those special ones that holds a place in my heart. And I remember hearing a lot about it when it was about to come out and playing the festivals, and everybody was like, this is like pure action like we've never seen before. And I was so excited for it to come out, and it came and played like a week with like a single showing a day at Showplace Icon, and we couldn't make it to go see it because our work schedules just didn't line up with the days that it was playing. And it was like just killing me. And my coworker was like, oh, I've seen that movie. And I'm like, you haven't. No, it's like, it's brand new. And he's like, no. Like, and he started explaining it to me. I'm like, that does sound like the movie. And so then the next day he came in and he like gave me a disc, and his cousin had downloaded it and had a bootleg, but it was from overseas. And it was subtitled, but the subtitles were completely wrong. So the first time we saw it, it's like none of the language or the dialogue. They would just at points, they would just type out like the whatever Tagalog, wherever like the they would just type it out. Like it wouldn't even be translating it to English because they just didn't know how to translate it. And then other times they'd be like, oh, it's the pet pharmaceuticals, and it's like, wait, what? Like they're it's like veterinary. Like,
where are they reading? What is happening?
So yeah, so like our first time watching it was like hilarious, and then eventually we bought the Blu-ray and we went and paid and to screen it, and I mean, it's just I love it so much. So.
It's so good. It is. I love action movies, and that is
it's a classic.
Oh, yeah. Man, so many scenes in that are just like burned into my head. And then every time we watch it, a new one gets in there because like it's everything, so much is happening that you couldn't possibly take it all in the first time.
Yeah,
it's just so good.
It's nice. Oh, good.
I was gonna say, like the Tagalog like language, hearing that also spoken is such. It was like one of those like movies where it's like, wow, this language is so cool sounding. Like I feel like we had seen some Indonesian movies, but they had all been dubbed, I think, at that point. And so hearing that language, and then also their fighting style is a mix of a few different things. And there's so much just like full body, like grabbing a full body and slamming it against a wall. Mm-hmm. And like, it's crazy the momentum that they're able to pull off with some of the things that they're doing and how fast they're moving. It's just, it's a completely unique fighting style that I hadn't seen before.
So yeah, great pick. Good movie.
All right, Colette.
Well, then I guess I'll have to talk about my action movie, which is Con Air.
It was supposed to be a routine transfer. The most violent criminals society's ever produced are being flown to the toughest maximum security prison ever built. Nathan Jones, a.k.a. Diamond Dog, life sentence, murder. Gun Green, a.k.a. the Marietta Mangler, 7 life sentences. Cyrus Grissom, a.k.a. Cyrus the Virus, life sentence for murder, robbery, kidnapping, extortion. And Cameron Poe, paroled, heading home to his family. Unfortunately, he just got on the wrong plane. From Jerry Bruckheimer, the producer of Crimson Tide and The Rock, Nicolas Cage, John Cusack, John Malkovich. This spring, buckle up. Con Air, directed by Simon West.
Yes.
I saw that movie in the theater when I was in high school. And I think I was being dragged along by somebody who just wanted to go see a movie. So I did not know a thing about it. And I watched it, and my friend was not into it. And we got to the end of the movie and I was like, this was amazing. Like, they landed a plane in Vegas. Like, what the hell? Yeah, I have a very special place in my heart for that film. And I think we rewatched it more recently. Mm-hmm. And I was like, this movie still holds up to me. And I don't know if it's just that I'm watching it through the lens of loving it so much, or if it really just holds up, but it is wild from the beginning to end. No element of it is grounded in reality, which makes every other element work in it. It's just, I love that movie so much.
Yeah. Great, great cast.
great cast, like ridiculous cast.
Ridiculously great cast. Yes. Mm-hmm. I loved it for so long and I didn't know everyone liked it. You know, I thought maybe this is just, this hits for me. And then every time I bring it up, everyone loves it. It's mm-hmm. like Roadhouse. Yeah. Everyone likes it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Except for whoever who took me to that movie, they were not happy. And I was like, you are out of your mind.
John Malkovich is great in that movie.
Yeah.
So good. Steve Buscemi is good. John Cusack is good. Yeah. Everybody's great.
Even Nicolas Cage with his wig. Oh. He's awesome. Mm-hmm.
So good.
I mean, Nicolas Cage is always good.
True. Yeah. It's true.
Yeah. It's
mostly. Mostly good.
Mostly good. Even when he's bad, he's good. Yeah. So Con Air.
All right,
awesome
Greg.
Pick.
Second to last.
All right.
Pull a teeth here.
Mitchell.
Mitchell, people don't like you. What kind of a policeman are you anyway?
Brute force with a badge. His name is Mitchell. Joe Don Baker is Mitchell.
Nice.
It's the Mystery Science Theater version. I do like the uncut version a lot. It does have more John Saxon in it, and it is more of a plot. It makes a little more sense why Mitchell's like Mitchell is. And the plot is a lot thicker with him and Linda Evans as well, Greta. Mm. But Mystery Science Theater became a thing to me because of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
I've probably seen that movie more times than anything else. Nothing comes as close as Mitchell. Mm-hmm. They were on fire on that one. I feel kind of bad for Joe Don Baker sometimes because I know he doesn't like it. I don't blame him. I mean, they do pick on him. And I mean, his character is supposed to be like that, but
right.
I don't care. It's funny. It's too good. It's I still quote lines from that every day.
Yeah. We quote that one a lot also. Like, mm-hmm. we're like, especially now during the COVID times when we're going on walks more often or like are outside. It's like, oh, my heart's going to explode. Like,
heart's pounding, veins clogging.
Mitchell, coming through. Mitchell.
I don't pay for your hookers, Mitchell. Well, would you?
Oh, if that's John Saxton, I'm dead.
I mean, literally anyone you meet who knows that, you can immediately say, and she's an acrobat. Yeah. or if you say cedar lattice, mm-hmm. they will literally say.
Works every time.
Exactly.
Or the spotted cuckoo bird flies backwards at midnight.
Yeah. It's a fine day for pontooning.
Yep.
My wife's a big fan of that too. We have, I have the original Rhino VHS.
Mm-hmm.
I have the Blu-ray that came in the box set. Mm. And I had the original poster for it, but I gave it to my friend Dan as a gift because he's a big fan. I bonded with more people and made more friends because of Mitchell. It's so funny.
It's so good, though. Ugh.
It is. Everyone I've ever shown this to loves it. Yeah. I've mm-hmm. never not had a showing that went bad.
Yeah.
So that's it.
Mitchell.
That was Mitchell.
Mitchell.
My mitten.
So my second to last, I felt like I couldn't look over Something Weird video because I feel like that has changed so much of how I watch movies in that. And I feel like that was sort of my introduction to some of this weird regional, like crazy low budget filmmaking. And so I think they got to go with the godfather of them all, Blood Feast.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're about to witness some scenes from the next attraction to play this theater. This picture, truly one of the most unusual ever filmed, contains scenes which under no circumstances should be viewed by anyone with a heart condition or anyone who is easily upset. We urgently recommend that if you are such a person or the parent of a young or impressionable child now in attendance, that you and the child leave the auditorium for the next 90 seconds.
And it was the first time I'd seen a movie quite to that level outside of Mystery Science Theater, obviously, where it was just like, how is this a movie? And like, how, like, this is, movies can be made to this like insane level of budget and just weirdness. And it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And it's just sort of meandery and the shots are really bad. And like some of the acting is really stiff or like the dialogue doesn't match like their mouths. And it's just like, what is going on? It was kind of hard to pick between that and like Something Weird with like the movie Something Weird, which I also really love. But Blood Feast is one that I've watched a bunch of times. We used to put it on when we'd have people over for parties and things like that with the sound off. And it just made me fall in love with Something Weird video and want to track down more and more and more of these movies and more as many Herschel Gordon Lewis movies as we could. I love the things that the weird decisions these movies make that no filmmaker in their right mind would ever do, but yet that's what you're watching. And it's really special. And it's also, again, one of those early DVDs that we had. Actually, we purchased it when it came out. Like, they had a box set of the Blood trilogy. And one of the special features, like a lot of those Something Weird discs would have little short films and stuff on them. There's a short film on the Blood Feast disc that's called Carving Magic, and it's a meat carving documentary starring the lead actor from Blood Feast, and it's a lot of the same crew who worked on Blood Feast did this weird educational film about how to carve turkey, and it's literally just him berating his friend at a dinner party about how he's so stupid and how he's never been able to carve a turkey. And, oh man, I gotta film this. We gotta watch. Oh, he's gonna mangle the bird, whatever. And like, it's just like,
you do.
Yeah, and it's just, I thought it was like the funniest thing. And we would watch this short over and over again. I played it for a bunch of people because I was like, this is just the weirdest short film, educational short film I've ever seen. So much so that they go into like how to carve turkeys and how to carve hams and stuff like that, leading to like a handful of years later, maybe like, I don't know, maybe 10 years later or something. Mm-hmm. We're at Colette's mom's for Thanksgiving one year. I've been a vegetarian pretty much my whole life. So I don't eat meat, but we're at Thanksgiving and her husband or boyfriend at the time wasn't there to carve the turkey, and the turkey was done. and nobody knew how to carve it. She was like, yeah, you can carve it. And I was like, I can try, I guess. So I literally had to like think back to that short film about how to carve it. And then I carve a turkey. And then he comes home, like her boyfriend comes home, and it's just like, who carved this? They did an amazing job. I, like, I guess that educational film worked out.
Like, we should not have doubted the importance of carving magic.
So, yeah.
Yeah. You laugh and laugh and laugh, but what happened? You learned.
Came in handy.
I think Riff Trax did a version of that, because I'm pretty sure I've seen that.
Carving magic?
Maybe not. Maybe.
Oh,
yeah.
It's possible they did, though.
It's.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they did, but I may have seen it on the box set as well, because I did have access to that once.
Yeah. But yeah, it's and like, again, it's not like a favorite by any means. It's just one of those movies that when I saw that, I don't think I had seen a Herschel Gordon Lewis movie, and I hadn't seen those like the something weird kind of movies that we kind of know now. Like that was like my introduction. I remember renting it on VHS from Discount Video, and it was one of those things like, what am I watching? Like, this is a foreign world that I'm not aware of, and this is like opening my mind up to a whole different subgenre and a whole other realm of movies and movie making. So I appreciate that.
That one in particular has a lot of elements that aren't present in all of the movie, like all of those films. Like, that one just has a lot of weird stuff happening, mm-hmm. like in it, and it's a good one to be introduced to that genre with.
Yeah.
I started, Joe Bob Briggs introduced me to Herschel Gordon Lewis, and I saw Wizard of Gore first.
Oh, mm-hmm. yeah
which is a pretty twisted film too. Mm-hmm. I think my favorite, if we're going to talk favorites, is probably 2000 Maniacs. Mm-hmm. I think that's, most people agree that's probably his best one.
It's another really good one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it doesn't have the weird, maybe plastic eyebrows. And like the grease paint that they like comb through that guy's hair to make it look like he has gray hair.
Yeah.
There's some things in it where I'm like, what is happening?
Yeah.
Let's make him look old. Just put gray powder in there and brush it through.
Baby powder. It works every time.
Yeah. It's believable. All right, Blood Feast.
Well, then my last one pulls together some of the genres that I had touched on before, and that is Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
Nice.
I watched that movie so many times when I was a kid, probably partially because of the animated parts, but also because it's a gritty detective noir. But it also has like a social commentary theme like in it as mm-hmm. well, where you're like learning about how the how the cable car systems in the United States got like dismantled by the car companies. Like mm-hmm. it's so sneakily being like, yeah, here's a funny story with a funny rabbit. And also, did you guys know?
I mean, it's got it takes that from the film noirs. It's like, I mean, it's totally like, it's so awesome.
It's such a good movie. It's still probably, what is his name? Bob Hoskins?
Mm-hmm.
His interacting with that world, I always forget that it's not really happening, because he is so seamlessly interacting with things that aren't there. Like mm-hmm. it is one of the best performances of that kind ever.
Yeah, he's a phenomenal actor, and it's like definitely more like well known in the UK for all his crime movies and stuff that he did. But like, yeah, it's weird that like that's what everybody in the US they think of Roger Rabbit. But mm-hmm. I mean, like rightfully so. I mean, he's incredible in that movie.
Oh yeah,
he's great. Yeah,
yeah.
I think everyone steps up their game in that. Christopher mm-hmm. Lloyd,
God, yes,
he's legit scary.
Yeah.
So scary. I don't remember how old I was when I saw it the first time, but like I was legitimately, I watched Taxi a lot as a kid for some reason, the TV series. And so then I was like, that's the same guy? Like, no, he's evil. Well,
he was Doc Brown, you know? I was like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
But also like, it's something I didn't really think about until we watched it more recently, is that they also like blend Disney stuff with Warner stuff.
Yeah.
It's the two, it's like Donald Duck and Daffy Duck like doing the piano thing, like facing off with each other.
Only Spielberg could have had the clout for that.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think that would have happened in the other world.
No, mm-hmm. there's no way. It still boggles my mind that even he was able to pull it off. It's crazy.
Right.
There's no way. I can't imagine that would ever happen now.
And they're kids. Yeah. And they're, it's right. Like Disney properties in there, and they're straight up murdering cartoons.
Yeah.
They're like boiling them essentially in paint remover.
You're right. Yeah, no way Disney would do that now, I guess.
Yeah.
Especially if they weren't the, you know, the main studio on it either, because I don't think Disney made that.
It was Touchstone.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, so that is Disney then. Yeah. Never mind. Yeah, great film.
One of my favorites.
All right, is it my turn?
Your last pick.
Okay, I'll keep this one. I'll go fast because I have a lot on this one, but I won't talk about everything. It's the Friday the 13th series.
Cheat.
That's a whole series, not a movie.
Yeah, well, I consider it one. If I had to pick one, it'd be part four.
Okay.
And that's what I'm going to focus on. Halloween's a million times better movie. Texas Chainsaw Massacre is a million times scarier. But Friday 13th is just the series itself. It's kind of like a, It's Wonderful Life to me. Mm-hmm. You know, where it's like it takes me to an okay place. And I don't know why, because it's about psychopathic. But part four is the one I was going to focus on. So I was going to focus on it now.
Which one is part four?
That's Corey Feldman and
final chapter. And it's the perfect sequel. It gives us a Crispin Glover, mm-hmm. who's a dead fuck. It gives us Laurie Monison, which is from Last American Virgin. So that's mm-hmm. where he came from. Corey Feldman, who's basically playing Savini as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's with their Judy Aronson, who was from American Ninja.
Mm-hmm.
And I met her at Minnesota Crypticon a couple years ago. Very nice lady. Then you had the skinny dipping with the Double Mint Twins. Tom Savini was back doing the special effects, which was amazing.
Yeah.
And then the ridiculous ending, you know, die, mm-hmm. die. Yeah.
Well, just
with his little shaved head.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. His little shaved head.
The way they take out Jason's great and very iconic now.
As his head slides down the machete. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And another quick thing is that they, it's always funny because they had that dumb ending where, and they completely dropped it, but was that Corey Feldman was at the end, like, is he the new Jason? You know, that character.
Yeah.
And then they did that same thing with Halloween 4.
Yeah.
You know, or like, and they dropped that, they got to, they ended it with her. Is she now going to be?
Mm-hmm.
Where's the dang corkscrew, Ted?
Oh, Crispin Glover.
That dance he does is so good.
So
the
good.
Dance.
Oh,
yep.
God.
Of all those franchises, though, the first Friday the 13th is my favorite. I love that movie. I love everything about that movie.
I like it too, but it's just, yeah, yeah. Sorry, I mean to cut you off, but that's why I pulled the whole series card when I knew that. I knew I was going to get called out on it, so I was like, be prepared.
So you went from 5 movies to 15 movies is what you're saying?
Mm-hmm. At least.
I was just going to go to, I actually, when I say series, I only mean up to 7.
Oh, okay.
For the record.
Yes, I mean, blood. There are some good ones. Yeah. That's that. Jason Goes to Space. That's a good one.
Jason Goes to Space is all right. I actually liked the Freddy versus Jason movie. Mm-hmm. I thought that was fun.
We saw that in the theater at Block E, mm-hmm. downtown Minneapolis. Not there anymore.
Late opening night. And it was so rowdy. People were chucking things. And people
that would have been a rowdy
crowd. Like everybody had beer. It was just mm-hmm. like all the people working that night were wearing Freddy sweaters or Camp Crystal Lake t-shirts
mm-hmm.
at the theater. And it was just like, it was a packed screening of people just like, cheering for Jason, cheering for Freddy, like mm-hmm. sides of the theater were like booing each other. It was just like,
how fun. That must have been a blast.
The greatest screening.
Afterwards, I went to the bathroom and I thought I'd walked into a fight and I was like, oh God. And then I realized what was happening was that a whole group of ladies were arguing with one lady and the group of ladies were like, Freddy's so much scarier. You don't know what you're talking about. And the lady was like, no, Jason is scarier. And I just like joined her side. I was like, she is right. And we just argued with them for like 5 minutes. Like, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a great series.
Yeah. It is. It's fun. It's fun. Mm-hmm. I mean, then I love part 5 because it's this stupid TV movie version of it, but it's so awesome.
It's so squeezy, though.
Is that
I love part 5. That's when they introduce They just introduce characters to kill them.
Yeah.
I like that guy. Random greasers on the side of the road, the weird like redneck couple, like the mom and son, and
the diner worker and the guy who comes pick her up. Like,
yeah, the diner worker is, you know, got like this nerdy boyfriend who's just like, it looks like a, you know, like a nebbish kind of accountant type, but he loves Coke, so he's
then flurries up the nose.
Well, then we got Demon and his girlfriend.
Oh, I love them.
I mean, there's see, this is what I'm saying. Yeah. That's why I couldn't just pick four. But anyway, enough. Yeah. We'll revisit that, I'm sure.
Right. So yeah, my final film is one that I'm sure that people have heard me talk about whenever I've talked about movies and movie screenings that changed me in a certain way or changed my tastes. And it is Lucio Fulci's The Beyond.
You are Liza, aren't you?
Yes.
My name is Emily. I've been looking for you. Leave this place.
Able to see that at the Uptown midnight screening in the mid-90s, and it was the first Italian horror film I believe I ever saw. I was in high school at the time, and I went and they played vintage trailers beforehand. They had a trailer for Cannibal Holocaust, they had a trailer for the original Evil Dead, they had a trailer for Detroit 9000. It was just like, and Deep Red, it was like, and the trailer even said the Deep Red Hatchet Murders was the name that they were using on that particular trailer. And I just remember it was a packed theater. I didn't really know what I was getting into. My brother told me to go see this movie, The Beyond. I didn't know anything about it. And like when the trailer started playing and people were cheering for the Evil Dead trailer, and it was just like just another rowdy, like total grindhouse experience. But then once the Beyond started, it blew my mind. Like it was the combination of the music, the visuals, the gore, the kills in that movie are insane. It just, and like the weird nightmare logic and the dubbing, it was just like a combination of all these things that like I didn't really know what I was in for, and it was just like total sensor overload. And after that I became obsessed with Italian movies and Italian soundtracks and just trying to track down as many as I could possibly see. And I would remember driving into Uptown to go to Discount Video and talking to the guys behind the counter about what other Italian movies I should check out. And they were, you know, they were recommending the giallos and they were recommending all these different things. And I learned really quickly that the two owners, one really liked Mario Bava and one really liked Dario Argento. And they would always constantly argue with each other of who was better. And I knew whoever was working that, like, I'd play that angle to try and get on their good side, to try and get some more like weirder titles recommended to me. And just the Beyond was one of those. It was just this total life-changing experience seeing that in the theater in that particular setting at that point in time. I just like, it's forever burned in my memory as like just like this amazing experience. So
that sounds like a blast. Was that that was the Tarantino's
Rolling Thunder was distributing it, but it was when Grindhouse Releasing had just done a restoration for the like an uncut version for the first time. It was like they had struck that print, I believe is my understanding.
Soon after, I think they did Cannibal Ferox did a tour from Grindhouse
I love that movie.
The Beyond also has my favorite forgetful logic in a movie where like you're like they're like heroes are like trying to figure out what's going on, and then they suddenly forget the thing that like solved all their problems. But like the main guy walks into like every room that has zombies in it, and he's like, shoot them in the chest, shoot them in the leg, shoot them in the arm, shoot them in the head, they die, sweet, next room, shoot them in the chest, shoot them in the arm, shoot them in the other arm, shoot them in the head, all right, next room.
or shoot them in the head, I'm out of bullets. I'm just gonna keep carrying this gun around, I'm gonna walk through a doorway and then just start firing again without reloading it. That just happens repeatedly.
Logic definitely is not the Beyond strong suit. Nope. I mean, yeah, that's, it is a great film.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of those movies that whenever it gets brought up, I'm like, God, I can kind of go for that movie again. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
it's definitely one that we watch almost every Halloween season, I feel
And again, introducing it to different people constantly.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, I guess we've gone through our five. We are running really long here, but let's try and get to our final segment, which was we were each tasked with picking a soundtrack that we, again, it's not our favorite necessarily, but it's one that we go to again and again, and just sort of is one that we feel like speaks to our tastes or is a warm blanket or whatever. Let's start with Colette. You want to go with your first? Your soundtrack pick?
My soundtrack pick, yes. I was only torn between two, but I ultimately went with New York Ripper. It is a soundtrack that we came across before we'd seen the movie, and I had it on my iPod when I was working a job where I'd bike there all the time, and it was in my biking mix, and every time it came on, I'd just be like, oh, this is so great, and because I was wearing headphones, I could like pull apart all the different like sections of it. Yeah, I really, really like it. Especially what is the one that the track I like the best?
New York One Night. I feel like the first track is just, I think it's just New York Ripper, but then the New York One Night is the one that you were saying is your favorite.
Yeah. It's definitely got my favorite drum track of any song maybe in it. I love it.
So here's a little bit of that one.
The drum track is, I don't know if this is what they're really doing, but it starts out, they play it one way, and then after that sax solo, they reverse it, it seems like, or something. Because the end drum hit for sure is reversed. But I really, everything about, especially that song, it's just well orchestrated and just so great. And it doesn't, it's not like, I was biking to it, but it's not like a really like, you know, up energy thing, but like it's so, it would set like a really nice pace that I could like handle for 45 minutes that it took me to bike it.
It's such a lovely song for such a misogynist movie.
Yeah, I was gonna say, once we saw the movie, I was first of all surprised it was a horror movie, because that whole soundtrack I thought went to just like a Italian cop movie. But yeah, it is a
title didn't give you a hint, huh?
No, I mean, I guess I thought it would be more focused on the cops or something. I don't know. But it is not. I absolutely fucking hate that movie. I will never recommend that. I had to write up a bunch of, who's the director? Why am I blanking?
Lucia Fulci.
Lucia Fulci. I had to write up a bunch of Fulci movies for the Trilon blog or the Trilon calendar. And I was like, I'm not writing anything nice about New York Ripper. They're like, you can do whatever you want. I was like, cool. And I was like, here is a whole page about the soundtrack. Do not see this movie. Here are five movies to see instead.
Yeah, it's a brutal movie. It's weird too. Donald Duck killer thing.
It's very, very little redeeming about that film, but the soundtrack is definitely the main redeeming thing.
The soundtrack is by Francisco De Masi. All right, Greg.
My choice. Now, see, recently I've been watching Nathan Hayes a couple times because I'm doing another project with that movie. And the music on that movie is really good. It's written by Trevor Jones. And Trevor Jones wrote the one song, the one soundtrack that I bought that wasn't a horror soundtrack first was The Last Mohicans.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, apparently, you know, the original they wanted electronical soundtrack to that movie, which is really weird because I can't picture that with synths.
Were they trying to do like Maurice Jarre or something? Do you know?
Possibly. They approached Trevor Jones and asked him to do that. He said, no, I see this as classical. and he won Michael Mann over on that. The main melody that everyone knows, that da 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 da, was based on a song, or taken from a song called The Gale by a Scottish singer-songwriter, Dougie McLean, which I didn't know. I'm just going to put up the main theme, which is pretty simple, but it plays over the opening credits, and it just sets the tone for the movie. It's up there with like Superman and Star Wars as far as these memorable things that just have a, it's very beautiful. So that's mine. Nice. Last Mohicans.
Nice. This was, I think it was harder for me to pick a single soundtrack than anything in this whole thing. And I went back and forth between a bunch of different stuff. And I really wanted, I was going to go with the Beyond or Deep Red because Italian soundtracks was like totally like what got me into hunting down vinyl and hunting out a bunch of that stuff in the first place. But then I just literally changed my mind just now because I was like, well, Colette did a Italian score. So just like, I don't want to double up on Italian scores. So I'm actually going with a little bit more modern one from the early 2000s. Is the David Holmes score for Ocean's 12. He did all the Ocean's movies for Soderbergh, and they're all fantastic scores. But there was a point in time where I was like obsessed with like spy jazz and a lot of like kind of classic like Sid Dale and a lot of that orchestration stuff. But there was something about the David Holmes scores that when he had done at that time period, and I was like just starting off by one of my bands, International Espionage, and it was something I was listening to a lot and like totally taking inspiration from, even though our band sound had nothing to do with it. But it was just something that like totally like got me obsessed with these heist movies and these spy movies, even though they were modern ones, which they're fantastic films in themselves. But the scores are so amazing. So here's What Are We Stealing by David Holmes on Ocean's 12. Anyway, yeah, that whole soundtrack is it's mixed with like classic kind of Italian cues, and then the modern stuff that David Holmes did. It was all very kind of funky and driving, and it just like it's got like some kind of great little surf, little guitar riffs in it, and fuzzy kind of surf. It's so good.
I like it a lot. I've never noticed it, but now that I hear it, I remember it.
Mm-hmm.
The soundtrack I remember in a heist film that I really liked was. As well, at least, was the Thomas Crown Affair with the remake, the one with Pierce Brosnan and Rene Russo.
Yeah.
It was like a nice jazzy, a little more relaxed than that, but it was fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that kind of spy jazz, kind of crime jazz stuff. It's so good. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I feel like that one's a little bit underrated. I don't know if a lot of people talk about the Ocean's movies, especially like the soundtracks, but all three of them have amazing soundtracks. Or scores. They're kind of a mixture of score soundtrack, I guess, hybrid. Yeah. So yeah, that's our picks. We've rambled enough, I believe, but we're going to keep working out the kinks. So anybody who's listened this long, thank you for listening along and thank you for bearing with us as we figure this out. We're going to keep getting the hang of this, paring it down, working out the kinks, working out the bugs.
But Greg could edit this down to a 20-minute thing. You we never don't know.
We have no idea. Yeah.
I was going to cut everything. It's not me.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. But yeah, we'll be back next week, and we're going to talk about Blood next week, which is a...
Ooh.
Oh, yeah. It's going to get real weird.
But and red.
You can follow along. We have a Video Killers Facebook page. We have a Tape Freaks Facebook page, and we also have tapefreaks.blogspot. where we'll be posting episodes and probably some photos and maybe some more links and things like that once we get the episodes up.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll keep figuring this out as we go along. But so, yeah, thanks everyone for listening. And this was the Video Killers Podcast.
Bye.
Good night.
2
You have the right.
Go kill again. He enjoys killing.
To remain silent.
You really think a cop did this?
Forever. Maniac Cop Rated R.